Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Ben Burgess will talk about Christopher Hitchens, the subject of his new book, and Patrick Blanchfield will psychoanalyze American society's relationship with one of Freud's more controversial concepts, the death drive. Christopher Hitchens died a bit over 10 years ago, on December 15, 2011, at the age of 62. Younger people might have little or no idea who he was, but he was an important writer at the Anglophone left from the early 1980s until his death, a columnist for The Nation magazine for 25 years until he left the magazine over support for the invasion of Iraq and George Bush's war on terror. In the meanwhile, he'd also broken into the big time as a columnist for Vanity Fair. For those of us who liked and admired him, his turn to the right was very sad. I could never hate him the way some came to. He was always very friendly and generous towards me, even after his tergiversation. But he turned harshly at some of his old friends, notably Edward Said. Does his work still matter? My next guest says very much so. Ben Burgess is a philosophy instructor and a columnist for Jacobin. He's the author of several books, all published by Zero, including Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, which he talked about on their show in April. Now he's just out with Christopher Hitchens, what he got right, how he went wrong, and why he still matters. In it, Burgess reviews Hitchens' career, bright and dark spots with several detours along the way that examine atheism in philosophical terms and Trotskyism, a tendency Hitchens was devoted to in his youth. Ben Burgess. Let me start with the third part of your subtitle, Why He Still Matters. Why should we care about this fellow who died a little over 10 years ago and seems a relic of a different time? Why does he still matter?
He's a really interesting figure, if only because of the range of things that he wrote and talked and debated about. And also, I think, because trying to think a little bit harder about Hitchens maybe gives us the opportunity to see how to understand some things about that different time that you're just talking about. If we see what happened to Hitchens in his last years, not just as a personal moral failing, although it certainly was that, but as a product of larger things that were going on, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, I think that might help us understand that time a little bit better.
What sort of things are you thinking of?
You know, this really gets us to the second part of the subtitle, you know, the, how he went wrong. I think that has to do with what the immediately post-Cold War world was like. So even though Hitchens himself was, you know, originally a Trotskyist in the, you know, late 60s and still had more than a little bit of residual Trotskyism as political bloodstream as a more moderate socialist, you know, for after that. The fall of the Soviet Union, even for people who didn't politically identify with the Soviet Union, really made it much harder to think in terms of and to take seriously the idea that the kinds of things that people were arguing and fighting about through the most of the 20th century were still live issues in the way that they had been before that.
I remember when the Soviet Union fell, some people on the left were saying, oh, now this will be easier on us. We won't have to defend the Soviet Union anymore. That seems, in retrospect, to be a very bad judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. We're recording this right after the 30-year anniversary of the Soviet Union officially breaking up. I will say, I think that a lot of people in the West have a very understated idea of what that actually means, right? I mean, like this really played out in that part of the world, you know, like a dystopian science fiction movie in a lot of ways, you know, it's pretty apocalyptic consequences of that in the immediate post-Soviet era for them, wars and destitution and all of that stuff. But I think for the rest of us, in a long-term way, what you're describing people as thinking might be kind of right, that in other words, that 25 years after the Soviet Union broke up, that might have in some ways made it easier for there to be socialist political breakthroughs in a country like the United States, you know, because it was no longer associated with that. Before that, the immediate effect in the 90s and 2000s, the first couple of decades after the Soviet Union broke up, as you suggest, is exactly the opposite. That, you know, even the idea was pretty pervasive. And this is not to say, of course, that plenty of people didn't manage to hunker down and keep the faith, you know, but the idea was pretty pervasive that this sort of grand conflict between different ideas about how to organize societies that had defined the 20th century was just over now. Liberal capitalism won. and all there was left was to argue about the details, a debate I mentioned very briefly in the book, where Christopher Hitchens and Jesse Jackson were debating two guys from the National Review about the death penalty, and Ed Koch was moderating for some reason. In that debate, that's from 1997, and, you know, Hitchens still sort of casually says things about the goal of his politics, you know, being a classless society, and even quotes Ingalls without attribution about the administration of things. This was becoming increasingly thin. He was still saying a lot of the things that he'd always said, but I think he was finding it increasingly hard to take seriously the idea that some kind of socialist political project was still meaningfully on the table.
I remember I interviewed him when the Orwell book came out. I really wanted to interview him about his political turn, but he insisted that we had to talk about Orwell some. So I let him talk about Orwell some. But then I asked him to describe where he was, and he said, well, I have principles but not affiliations. I wasn't quite clear what the principles were, but I guess by affiliations he meant no longer socialist.
I think that's right. So if you read, not very long before the Orwell came out, the Letters to a Young Contrarian came out, and that one was published, you know, shortly after 9/11, so it certainly would have been written at minimum several months before, probably longer. I think it's a really interesting transitional fossil for what you're talking about, because there is still quite a bit of affection for the socialist tradition in that book, quite a bit of sort of defense of various figures, you know, having been on the right side at the time. But that's the one where he sort of formally gives up on the prospect of socialism ever happening. Even the next year, 2002, there's this, you know, fascinating exchange that he has with his friend, you know, Martin Amis, the novelist, where Amis is basically taking him to task for, you know, having once been a communist and not having admitted how bad it was. Hitchens is really ferociously defending the record of the kind of Marxist that, you know, that he was, and, you know, of that tradition. At the same time as he's sort of making these casual statements that, you know, that said, it's over now. It's not going to happen. And even much later than that, very close to the bitter end, you know, there are these statements where he sort of playfully refers to himself as a very conservative Marxist, by which I take it what he meant was that in his mind, he still accepted something like the Marxist theory of history, but he no longer thought that the normative, you know, political program was viable. You know, he was no longer attached to that, which I argue in the book is a really essential thing to understand for understanding what happened to him at the end, you know, because when he says, you know, I have principles but not affiliations, well, the principles had to do with sort of support for whatever kind of secular and at least democratic values he still thought could be realized, right? So if these regimes like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, you know, which he had spent time in, he thought that, what, you know, eventually these regimes would be taken out by socialist revolutions, and then failing that, right, you know, he at least wanted, you know, democratic revolutions. And this is right up to the point in this chain of reasoning that I could remain sympathetic, you know, to what he's saying. But I think the really catastrophic mistake is convincing himself that the United States military could be the engine of democratic revolution in the Middle East, which there was no good reason to think that it could. And certainly the record since has shown that it can't be.
Towards the end of the book, you lament the state of political essay writing these days, you know, the fact that there's nothing memorable when it's published in the Daily Beast. That's something we should cherish about him, regardless of whatever political reservations you have about his turn. That kind of writing is very much out of fashion these days. And I don't know whether it's the material reality of the internet that makes it that way, our own rotting attention spans or what, but what happened to that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that some of it surely has to do with the internet and attention spans. Certainly, constant engagement with social media has done nothing good for mine.
Tell me about it.
No, I assume that that's, you know, not a, you know.
You're not alone on that one.
Exactly. So that is probably some of it. But I think that there is probably a broader materialist explanation for at least some of this, which is just that traditional media partially because of the existence of the internet and other things, has economically collapsed to a pretty amazing extent. The kind of career that Hitchens had is probably one that's not possible in that exact same form, or if it is possible, it's certainly a narrower path. One difference between the sort of formative decades of Hitchens as a writer and what most young writers have to do right now is just that he had more time. Just the fact that some of these outlets, my understanding is, right, you know, used to pay much more, you know, than they're able to pay right now. And that meant that you had to do less to support yourself. And so you could put more into it. You know, I think that's one difference. I also think, I wonder about this, actually. I'd be curious to know what you think, but like, I think that the fact that writers used to be insulated from their audiences in a different way than they are now might also contribute to it, right? I mean, like in, you know, if you were pissed off by something that Christopher Hitchens said in whatever, a Minority Report column for The Nation, you could, you know, write a letter to the editor.
Which, you know, had a certain stylistic standard, too. You just couldn't tweet something dumb.
Yeah, right, exactly, right? I mean, you had to put this effort into it. If you're actually literally sending a letter to the mail, you probably think about it for a while before you sent it off, if it wasn't, you know.
Yeah, I used to know that the letters editor at The Nation, and she was demanding. She wanted good stuff in that call.
Right, yeah. Like, I'm sure they only printed a very small minority of what they got. Whereas now, if people, it's, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to interact with writers online, and I think a lot of writers don't really know how to handle it. There are a lot of ways that you can react to that that are probably bad for the writing, you know, that you either have one and, you know, like kind of, you know, you're sort of looking behind your shoulder all the time to think about how people are going to react, which might help like homogenize the writing. Or else, equally badly, you might have what Megan Day has referred to as cancel brain, you know, which is where you become so obsessed with your haters that pissing them off and putting a plus wherever they put a minus and all of that starts to define your perspective in its own way. And either way, the result's not going to be very interesting.
I'm speaking with Ben Burgess, author of Christopher Hitchens, What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why He Still Matters, just out from Zero Books. The atheism is an interesting thing. He was for long an atheist, but it became very crucial to his brand kind of late in his life. To be devoted to the hatred of religion with, well, the quasi-religious fervor to me is very odd. But it also seems like a blindness to some of the more profound questions of human existence. You know, things that have obsessed people for the entire of human history, probably. What do you make of this passionate atheism? And, you know, it later merged with an Islamophobia, which is very convenient for him, and his other, the gang of new atheists he got hooked up with. Why the importance of atheism to him, and was it a flaw?
I talked to his brother, his kind of hilariously ultra-conservative brother, Peter Hitchens. And Peter, you know, who's very religious, is extremely devout Anglican, had told me that he thought this was the most consistent part of Christopher's worldview over the decades. That he said that, you know, that this is probably something he deeply felt since he was about 11 years old. And I don't know if that's a overstatement or not. What I will say is that this is definitely not a post 9/11 development in his view of things, that there are columns that he wrote in the early 80s where he says things about religion that are very similar to what he would say in 2007. It's got in his book, God Is Not Great. There's a piece, I think it was The Nation, 1982, called The Politics at God's Funeral, which is a review of a book by Michael Harrington, who Hitchens faults for still being, I don't know, too residually Catholic, I guess. The sort of things that he says in there suggest not only like a strong emotional attachment to the subject, which actually makes sense to me kind of for the same reason that you're faulting his atheism, that these are really fundamental human questions that religion answers. And so I think it's understandable that people, you know, that you're going to have strong feelings on all sides of them, but also that he, I think it really reflects what I do find more fault with about Hitchens' atheism, which is the kind of strident anti-theism. I guess the distinction that, you know, that I always make is that I'm a philosophy nerd. I enjoy arguing about subjects like this. I have strong opinions. I'm more than happy to, like, spend an evening arguing about religion. But insofar as I'm interested in politics and changing the world, it's overwhelmingly obvious to me that there are plenty of people who might share my metaphysical views who are the furthest thing in the world from being politically aligned with me, that some of those new atheists you mentioned who might have Islamophobic or neoconservative views, plenty of libertarians of the kind I joke in the book, you know, want a world where people would be selling their organs for Bitcoin to pay rent, are very stridently atheist. Whereas your Cordell West, you know, for example, seem like people who are very closely aligned with what I want politically, and they find things in Christianity that certainly accord with values that I hold dear. Full disclosure, you know, I'm married to a Christian leftist. And so I think that where I kind of get off the trade of Hitchens' atheism is at that anti-theism. Even though clearly he was not consistent about thinking that somebody disagreed with him about God, you know, made him his political enemy, right? I mean, he certainly didn't consistently apply that throughout his life. But he did consistently talk as if he believed that. And I think in the last few years, as you say, it really became like a much bigger fixation of his in the last, you know, really in the last 3 or 4 years of his life, especially. You know, an interesting contrast is to look at his Mother Teresa book, delightfully entitled The Missionary Position, which came out in the mid-late 90s. And that's an entire book devoted to attacking a Catholic religious figure, even though, I mean, he certainly held his anti-theist positions. He had, again, at least since the early 80s, according to his brother, a lot longer ago than that. In that book, he's not really that concerned with attacking her metaphysical beliefs. You know, I mean, like, really, he's much more concerned with attacking her chumminess with the Duvalier dictatorship in Haiti.
Well, if anything, you know, she was guilty of transgressing Christian principles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's wrap this up by considering the question of what happened. And what struck me, even at his best, when I used to read his column in The Nation in the 80s and 90s, he was never very interested in the classic concerns of left and socialist politics, the state of the working class. He was far more interested in what was going on around the Hindu Kush than you know, what would happen in the poorer neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. That lack of an anchor in working class politics or thinking about the state of the class struggle seemed to at least leave him vulnerable to a conservative turn. At least that's the way it struck me. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely part of the picture. In my favorite Christopher Hitchens book, No One Left to Lie To, his book about the Clintons.
That's a really good one. As someone who wrote a book about Hillary.
Yeah. And in that book, he does write very passionately about domestic policy, about the sort of Dickensian horrors of welfare reform. He talks about healthcare in that book.
Which he plagiarized a lot from Sam Husseini, it should be said. He did have a problem with plagiarism throughout his life.
Yeah, no doubt, right? The man was a machine for manufacturing good lines, but he was also willing to pick them up where he saw them and often not good about attributing them. That book, I mean, as good as it is an exception to the rule that for the most part, it's relatively rare that he spends that much time delving into issues like that. There's certain kinds of domestic issues that excited his moral imagination, like the death penalty, which we've already mentioned. But certainly those kinds of bread and butter domestic economic issues are not where he spent most of his time. Interestingly enough, shortly after he died, there's remembrance of him by Victor Nevasky, where Nevasky talks about Hitchens originally being hired at the Nation. He was originally there for like a year or 2 years as part of an exchange program with the New Statesman. And then he decided that he wanted to stay. And they were talking about, you know, sort of what to do with him. And apparently originally there was some talk of having him have like a column that would be devoted to weekly coverage of Wall Street, which I wonder about, right? As a path not taken, if writing about that every week, you know, like if he got along with that, would have led to a better version of Hitchens in the long term. But for the most part, you know, he was most interested in foreign policy and talking about the crimes of Henry Kissinger and talking about U.S. support for death squad dictatorships in Latin America. And he did a lot of really great work on these subjects. The lack of attention to those domestic bread and butter issues both left him vulnerable to that more conservative turn, in the sense that he was able to not spend as much time thinking about some of his new allies and the horrible things they supported on the domestic front, but also because of what I think is the bigger part of his transition is closely tied into this. As the 90s wore on, you know, and he got into this end of history era, the idea of, you know, the international working class as a agent for historical change started to seem less and less real to him. This debate that he did with Peter in 1999 at Conway Hall, where they're arguing about the EU, and which Christopher is already a big defender of, when the subject of the sort of democratic deficit, you know, European institutions comes up, you know, he talks in this incredibly vague way about how some sort of struggle for greater democracy on a Europe-wide scale is going to have to be waged. But as you listen to him talk about this, well, waged by who? How? Right? You know, and I think that this is directly ties into where he goes wrong, because lacking that sort of belief in the working class as an agent of historical change, you know, he sort of starts casting around for alternatives and ends up convincing himself that the American empire, despite everything, actually could be that vehicle, you know, because after the Cold War, the United States was no longer fighting against Vietnamese communists, for example. It was fighting against oftentimes people who were, you know, hard right wing in their own countries, who he saw as the equivalent of exactly the kind of monsters that the United States had propped up in Latin America in the 80s. You know, so, you know, Serbian right wing nationalists who he really thought of as Nazis, and then later, you know, the Saddam Hussein regime and the Taliban in Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and he could convince himself the United States was a vehicle for democratic revolution. And I think it is worth noting, too, that on the Islamophobia point you brought up a minute ago, I certainly would not deny that Islamophobia was in the mix in his later views. I mean, in the post-9/11 years, he had a wildly overstated view of the realistic level of threat that al-Qaeda-style terrorism could possibly pose to societies like the United States and the UK. But I don't think that Islamophobia was the original sin. And one reason that I don't think that is that really the occasion of him first warming up to the idea the United States could be a force for good in the world isn't any war where the U.S. was bombing Muslims. It was a war in which the United States was intervening on behalf of Bosnian Muslims against Serbian Christians.
Finally, on the class question, you know, he was kind of an Arab East. He was middle class, but really aspired to be more posh. I think the six-figure salary from Vanity Fair brought him in contact with a better sort of class. He once urged me to submit material to Vanity Fair because they desperately want to be seen as not trivial. And I think he thought of himself as a way to maybe civilize the upper orders. But he also liked to have parties that Alan Greenspan came to. You know, I think it was a class anxiety to him that he resolved by identifying upwards and then moving upwards very dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, he says in Hitch 22 that he remembers overhearing a conversation where his parents were arguing about whether to try to send him to expensive, you know, well, what they call public school over there, but, you know, expensive private boarding school. His father was a relatively low-level military officer, and it was a little questionable whether they could afford all of this, kind of borderline. And he remembers his mother saying, you know, if this country is going to have a ruling class, you know, I want Christopher to be part of it. So there is definitely that element of class ambiguity in his background and upbringing. I will say that the period in which he was actually the most radical was when he was a student at Oxford, you know, so he's definitely rubbing shoulders with the ruling class in that context. But I think there is a point of connection in terms of what happened to him later, which I don't think is necessarily as simple as him moderating his views to be more agreeable to the people around him. I mean, he certainly wasn't afraid of pissing anybody off. But I think it was more a question of, in the 60s, when he was a member of the International Socialists, whatever, he was still going to parties with the reactionary, you know, children of the very rich. But that was a time when those reactionary children of the very, very rich absolutely believed that socialism was on the agenda. You know, they were terrified of it. Whereas I think that the fact that he was having these parties, you know, where Alan Greenspan would show up or whatever, I think maybe does help to explain why he wasn't able to sort of keep his faith in radical change in late 90s and afterwards when other people, you know, were. Somebody who I often think of, you know, at the same time as Hitchens, you know, Alexander Coburn, who was a crank in certain ways and, you know, had some eccentric views, but still died as a member of the radical left.
But also born into the upper class and was confident of his class position.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. You know, but I think that the fact that he was spending time with people like that might have been relevant if only because if people like that knew that socialism was possible and they were afraid of it, you know, he could hold on to, you know, being a supporter of it. Whereas if he's around people all the time who are confident that that's all over now, then, you know, it might be difficult, you know, for that view not to start to seep into your soul.
I was Ben Burgess, author of Christopher Hitchens, What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why He Still Matters, just out from Zero Books. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Domenico Scarlatti's Sonata No. 302 in the Kirkpatrick catalog, performed by Scott Ross. And now the death drive. As COVID burns through the U.S. and much of the outside world, the indifference of so many people to its ravages put me in mind of Freud's concept of the death drive, which holds that alongside the human longing for eros and life exists a complementary longing for stasis, suffering even, and finally death. So I was very happy to come across Death Drive Nation, an essay by Patrick Blanchfield, in Late Light, the new journal of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. Blanchfield is a writer and an associate faculty member with that institute. His book, Gunpowder, on the Culture of Firearms in the U.S., should come out next year from Verso. Patrick Blanchfield. Watching the reaction of so many people, and it's not just the U.S., you see it in parts of Europe as well, but it seems particularly rampant here. Watching people's reaction to COVID made me think of the death drive as the most economical explanation of what looks like a reckless indifference to life and death. The death drive is a controversial issue in a lot of circles, even within psychoanalysis. But, can we start with a definition of what do we mean by the death drive?
Talking about the death drive in psychoanalysis, puns and like weird overdetermination is going to come fast and quick, but it is a pleasure to talk with. Right? Like, it's an unequivocal pleasure. About the death drive, two things just to say up front. One, it's a concept that emerges from psychoanalytic theory, first and foremost from the work of Sigmund Freud in sort of his later years, right? Post-World War I up until his death in the late 30s. It's a concept that's expanded by a whole suite of subsequent psychoanalytic thinkers who controversially revise or change or radically alter it, and also by a whole lot of critical theorists. The second thing that I'd say sort of just to define it is that it is a concept, but it's almost better to think about it as like a set of concepts or like a, to use a fancy term, like a problematic, right? It takes a bunch of terms and puts them in relation to one another. Or another way to think about it might be like a constellation, right? It's a configuration of things and like any good constellation, it can help you navigate it. And the terms in question that are put into play are terms that we generally think about as being opposed to one another or as being like contradictory, right? The idea of life is opposed to death. The idea of aggression towards the other is opposed to suicidal, self-directed aggression. The idea of pleasure is opposed to pain. The idea of the past is opposed to the future, right? These are like the terms that are in play. What the concept of the death drive or the discourse that produces different concepts of the death drive tries to do is to understand phenomena where those distinctions seem to break down, whether it be trauma where people seem to be stuck in the past and unable to move forward, or dynamics of external aggression that can rapidly toggle to self-directed aggression. Or, and this is, I think, the key point, it's about the ways in which pleasure or we or the human person or the socius or wherever we want to sort of situate the action have a tendency to doubling down on circumstances that are pleasurable in the short term, even as the costs of that mount up, even as it may ultimately be terminal, right? This idea of like drivenness towards an end that you're compelled to repeat, even though it may not necessarily seem rational. It caters to something else, like a beyond rationality that is beyond pleasure and also beyond of reason or sensibleness.
The concept is certainly rich in romantic poetry. I think of Wallace Stevens' Death is the Mother of Beauty. This notion of the end of conflict, the end of struggle, of just eternal rest, there's something appealing about that, even if it is about the demise of one's life and one's consciousness.
It is, right? And like there is a kind of, there is a tradition of thinking about the death drive, too, via some of the more poetic figures in psychoanalysis. And I'm thinking here of one of Freud's early interlocutors and one of the first women psychoanalysts, Sabina Spielrein, has this notion of the way she describes as destruction as a cause of coming into being. It's worth saying, just to, and she articulates this from her own positionality, right, as a Russian Jewish woman who has a variety of kids, and ultimately she and they are killed by the SS, right? But this idea that the production of new life is a brutal, bloody and potentially fatal business for the people involved and for women especially, but also that like there can be a peaceableness or a quietness that comes from the cessation of stimulus. I think there's a way to read the death drive that's about like revolutionary possibility. One basic idea to put on the table is this idea of what does life tend towards, right? And in the most like parsimonious way to think about this, right? Like what do living beings do? And they reproduce, right? And in fact, maybe we can glimpse a certain tonalities of the death drive in the way in which like genes are indifferent to whether or not the people who carry them, you know, live and prosper. The genes just want to reproduce themselves, right? They don't even want, they just do. And we sort of are along for the ride and then we're spent. But the other way of thinking about it is how Freud talks about it in this strange book, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, which starts off writing about being about wartime trauma and then makes many detours through children's play to like this biological mythos of like what he calls the germ layer, like the basic cell, is that the purpose of life is to, what life's all about is diminishing friction. It's about diminishing unpleasure. Right. It's a kind of essentially reactive, don't bother me, from the earliest moments of like the child screaming as it exits into the world, mewling to it, to like the way that the germ layer, this little like protista or like a hydra or something, is pushing away noxious chemicals and moving up and down a temperature saline gradient in the primordial soup. What we're always trying to do is push away noxious stimuli in favor of a kind of like quiescence, or at least a type of stasis. It's a maintenance of homeostasis that also can do us in. And that's like how it has a kind of tragic element to it.
But as the doctor said, there's no satisfaction in satisfaction.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, nothing's more unpleasurable than actually being satisfied. And there's this way in which like you can't always get what, you know, as the other famous psychoanalyst, Jagger et al. Said in their classic paper, right, you can't always get what you want. And so sometimes you get what you need, or rather like what's that figure of necessity is a good thing to put on the table here, right? Like it's this idea like, well, we individually get, we keep on pushing away things. I don't want to finish my book. I don't want to work out. I don't want to do all these things, right? And I keep on like making increasing exertions so as not to change certain patterns of my life. Even as the cost of that inertia mounts, I'm so tethered to a certain definable sort of like limited horizon of what's expectable and what I come to know and enjoy that I would rather not change it, even if it locks me into something that in the longer term is probably not going to be good.
But on the other hand, you might, in the depths of your unconscious, want to kill the editor that wants that book.
But I should say, I love my editor. I love all my editors that I work with. They're really good. Entree to think about something here, which is that like, that there's a tradition, this is part of the controversy about the death drive, of thinking about it in a very biological way, like making these grand claims about like cells and the way a cell wants to maintain its boundaries is the same way the state wants to maintain its ethnic boundaries and like Weimar and like Nazi Germany or something. And we don't need to necessarily tarry with that, because as the example of like projects that we don't want to finish, or like projects that we'll do like once we're dead or over our own dead bodies. Humans are not just cells. States are not just like metaphors for biological life. These are people, and collectivities operate on multiple levels of meaning, and it's always very overdetermined. It's super saturated with meaning. And so like there is some way in which in the example of COVID and like what's going on, I think, with capitalism more generally, is this like, well, our individual comfort, right, and the maintenance of certain standards of living, the negotiability of our way of life does translate into death. But it translates generally into death for people who are further away, right? That's like the aggression of numerous types of extractive enterprises. But also, you know, in the long term, sure, like maybe we boil ourselves off the planet. There's just ways in which like what's meaningful and what's imaginable for the individual or the social collective ramify or come back viciously in terms of what materially happens to people and to societies.
In the meanwhile, it's fun to drive my SUV, though.
There is pleasure in this. Like, I think my Freudianism and my Marxism get more vulgar as time passes, and that's probably good. We are driving around in vehicles that are powered by the liquid dead matter of the previous five great extinctions. And in doing this, not only are liable to like crash into walls or have our Teslas explode or whatever the hell we're doing, we're also basically fueling the sixth great extinction. And yet they're also awesome. They're pleasurable. The thing for me about the death threat, I think, is interesting, is that once you get into that territory and you start thinking about those dynamics of like collective ruin, but individual pleasure, or collective commitments to social imaginaries that produce death, like, I don't know, I think of the work of a conservative critic like Andrew Bacevich, for example, right? Who is, from the right and rights, but who also is, you know, very frank about describing what he just, you know, lays out of America's wars for the greater Middle East, or which he says are for oil. And he begins one of those books by talking about how pleasurable it was for him to get his first car after a summer job. Even he, on some level, is like vibing with a certain death drive logic, which he identifies, right? That this is non-negotiable. When Carter makes certain proclamations that we need to change our approach to energy or to international relations, we were like, no, we'll have it both ways. As a concept, it's messy, right? But I think it does illuminate certain things that are really not even just below the surface in American life or capitalism in general, but like throbbing right in front of us, and that we have to be acculturated or normalized not to talk about or not to see.
Well, I think of that great little Richard Klein book, Cigarettes Are Sublime. And the fact that a cigarette can kill you is in some sense part of its pleasure. You're really facing down death every time you take a puff. And that the pleasure of challenging mortality or you know, flirting with it is really underestimated.
Yeah, and it's real, right? Cigarettes and addictive substances are they're a great example of this, right? I miss smoking cigarettes terribly, right? Like, people still dream about these things like years after they've quit.
Oh, there's just no substitute for them.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it, both because like you know gets you going in various ways, but also it's something to do with your hands, right? It's cigarettes are like how you go out and stand on the corner, and that's how you prove to everyone that you don't give a but also you care. They're awesome. And much in the same way as like cars are awesome, or hell, you know, in the work, most of the stuff I write about involves like gun violence, like guns are super fun to shoot, right? I mean, taste is, you know, leave everyone to their own taste, but like guns are fun as hell, right? They can give you a feeling of thrill. They can give you a feeling of pleasure, right? Like you get to make something 100 miles, like 100 yards away, explode. And Freud is helpful on this. Like there's a line in, I think it's Civilization and Discontents, where he describes there's a kind of basic dislocation between people and technology, such that we produce technology that makes us very powerful, that doesn't necessarily cover up certain gaps in our own vulnerability or our own fantasies of invulnerability. And he has this line, like, we're prosthetic gods. And sometimes our prosthesis, our armature, sits on us nicely, but other times it makes us feel even more, it points to certain incompletenesses. And like, you know, the cigarette, it makes you feel great, even if it kills you. And then once it's gone, you're going to be missing it. You're going to feel that lack.
I'm speaking with the writer Patrick Blanchfield. Yeah, I think this is something that like a lot of liberals and leftists don't get. The pleasures of guns, the pleasures of cars, and even, you know, the pleasures of all these death-drenched practices that if you criticize them, you look like a scold. And this is what annoys people so much about environmentalists and liberals. And it's just you really have to take this on board if you're going to do any kind of serious critique of this stuff.
Yeah, like the fact that like libidinal economy, or like the circulation of pleasures, of fantasies, of satisfactions, of fears, of desires, like that actually is real in the sense that it shapes how we experience the world and our relations to others. And it, you know, it makes certain things imaginable and certain things unthinkable. Like libidinal economy exists alongside like material political economy, right? And you have to be able to keep both those things in mind, right? Because otherwise you wind up doing sort of these knowing better positions of analysis outside, right? Being, well, the real reason with the white working class is that they don't understand XYZ, right? And you sort of position yourself outside them. But, well, no, like what if actually racism is pleasurable for some people, right? What if some people would rather like starve than see their neighbor have even a little, right? Like, what if we take these propositions seriously, as I think as recessively should? And by the same token, I think it's worth saying, and this bears on how the death drive is something that's expressed not rawly, but in these meaning saturated human formations, there's a real pleasure in cruelty in a lot of liberal discourse.
Well, we're seeing these people, like, if unvaccinated people come to the emergency room, don't treat them. I've seen that, on liberal Twitter, and it's appalling to read that, but there is definitely a liberal cruelty there.
Yeah. And it ratifies basic material situations of power, right? This, like every time there's a natural disaster, you always have some asshole, whether it be, like one of these like share blue types. Look at the latest hurricane hitting all these people in deep red states, and this is what you get when you vote Republican. It's like, well, no. First off, the people who are being hit by this are most likely to be disenfranchised to begin with and not to be at the polls. But also, what is that but like enjoying the spectacle of someone else's suffering and like sharing that, and so the people who agree with you can revel in this position of being secure and also morally superior to abjected others who are suffering, but who you get to like relish their suffering because they supposedly chose and deserved it.
It's like Pat Robertson, blaming Hurricane Katrina on sodomy in New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. It's being like 9/11 happened because New York City is so gay. Like, it's absurd. It's a slightly different configuration of satisfaction in what you have, blaming people who are suffering because if they're suffering, they must have deserved it, and also kind of like warding off the anxiety of there for the grace of God go I. The people who are dying of COVID are people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. As institutions fail, right, and people have fewer and fewer choices, somehow we derive pleasure against that insecurity by putting this onus of blame and also a site of pleasure on other people's individual choices. We gave them opportunities, right? They could have gone, they could have spent a whole day on a website figuring out which health insurance exchange they wanted, but instead, no, they decided to go get COVID. So that's on them.
We look at the mass indifference towards COVID, large portions of this country, and the refusal to get vaccinated, which seems so irrational to me and to many others, but people embrace these decisions and fight literally to the death to defend them. How do we read that in the light of the death drive?
I think it can be read a bunch of ways. One thing I think about is, and this is sort of a basic term in a lot of death drive discourses, this idea of control. So one succinct sort of way that Freud defines a death drive, again, in this confusing book that he spins out about it and he revisits it later, is this idea that, like, the organism wants to die on its own terms. This idea that, like, you want to ensure that if you go out, You were the captain of your own ship and the master of your own destiny, or the protagonist of reality, or any other metaphor we want to use. You're going to end in any event. You know this, and whether you acknowledge it or not. But at least you're not vulnerable to someone else. A parallel logic here is like from my cold dead hands with guns, right? Which sometimes sounds like a threat of aggression towards the other, being like, God damn it, you come take my guns, I'll shoot you. But oftentimes it's basically just a suicide vow. Yeah, you can take them from me, and after I've chosen to liquidate myself and liquidate my family. And by the way, this is one of those points where you have some data between, and you can point like a quilting point between the libidinal and the material, insofar as that, like, there is data about places where people, and like, I think it's Missouri and elsewhere, where there have been, in response to uprising against police violence, lots of ex-urban or suburban whites have bought guns explicitly to protect themselves from people in the urban core who they'll probably never see, but they feel a sense of status anxiety, et cetera. So they buy guns to defend themselves. And what could be more about protecting yourself than defending yourself with a gun? Well, statistically speaking, what's going to happen most likely is that you're going to kill yourself or your family or both. To stand there is not to like stand outside and be like, well, that's so much we know better and people are making decisions, but rather being like, people are making decisions in terms of like what they feel that they can control over and against what they feel is being foisted upon them by others. They get to set the terms. I'm not going to let the government put vaccines in my body. Sure, I may let like pollutants enter my body, or sure, I may let a lot of other things, but this is one of those points where I choose to take this stand, even if it kills me and kills other people. And in some ways it is, I think, analogous to the way in which middle-aged men, as they hit bankruptcy, health issues, or other types of social stressors, for, again, exacerbated by the lack of a social safety net, become statistically more likely to kill themselves and their partners. And there's something, destruction of the self and those around you as a last statement, or as like an ultimate or most meaningful statement of relevance or agency. It's not just that the politics are stupid or bad, but what if people like choosing to die of COVID, even if they don't see it that way, is also something that they see as a profoundly political act?
Well, they certainly do see it that way, but and you cannot convince a lot of those folks that their decision affects other people. It's not just that they're going to do themselves in, but they could be doing others in.
Yeah, it's only others that you can't see. It's others that are in the service professions, right? It's others that there's a neat like way in which the anti-vax thing, I think, points to the contours of the solipsism of a lot of American consumer life. It's the essential workers who are going to have to deal with it. I will make my own individual choice. That my home is my castle, I've seen interviews with people, like, I think with many of us have seen these things, and they go viral for a good reason, where people are, you know, in a literal hospital bed talking about how now more than ever, as they recover from COVID, they'll never get vaccinated. They beat it. They individually did it. You have to wonder what type of like collective imaginary and what type of collective social circumstances produces people who are so immiserated in their imaginaries and so like morally deadened that this is like that's the stand that they want to take, that they think that that's how it plays out.
How does this fit in with American imperial violence? I mean, this country has been saturated in imperial violence from the moment of its founding to the present. Does this have an effect on how the death drive manifests itself in daily life?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so profoundly, right? Like, look, this is another one of these things that's going to sound like it's a little glib, like with the cars and the way they run on dead dinosaurs and plants, and maybe we're killing all the other animals and ourselves, and they're fun to drive. We can't imagine life without cars. But, like, look, you know, we're talking on a continent that was initially quote-unquote settled thanks to people who advantageously deployed not only, like, settler colonial violence and liquidation and extraction, but literally saw a plague that they were vectors of and multiple plagues that killed people who were, you know, didn't have the antibodies for it, but saw that outcome as a sign of God's favor. Part of what's particularly intense about settler societies, of which I think the U.S. is a kind of paradigmatic one, because it's both a settler society and also a settler empire in this double way, is this constant like erasure or unwillingness to work through the violence of the past that is continually instead productive of a violence that's directed now in the present and that repeats certain terms of it. I think it's not a coincidence that the people who are most disproportionately affected by COVID, you know, in terms of mortality rates, are people on, you know, are indigenous people, are Native Americans, are blacks, are people who are poor, right? It's people who were traditionally disposable and whose disposability was a sine qua non for the American empire. And like things don't repeat themselves verbatim, right? But history does kind of rhyme. And in a country that's basically haunted and that refuses to think about the past or do any type of like what you call like a working through of our violent history and our ongoing relation to that history in terms of present violence, like it kind of makes sense that history would rhyme, right? We're haunted by this. It's going to keep happening in certain ways. And just to sort of like put a really bleak, but I think necessary thing to say here, like looking forward, part of what we're seeing in terms of death drive and the way we're dealing with COVID is a normalization of the deaths of historically disposable, but like relatively more disposable others. And also people who like to think they're inured from that, but you know, it comes for us all in the end. What do we think the collective response is going to be to climate disasters? Right? We're already seeing this as they happen outside the U.S. core. In some ways, like we're living through a giant pedagogy in learning to normalize how the non-negotiability of a American way of life continually demands the sacrifice of the usual suspects.
And finally, and this is where my American meliorism comes out. Is there a way to put this culture on the couch and at least allow it to work through this death drive at all? Or are we just hurtling towards inevitable doom?
Honestly, I feel like we can work through it. Like, there's two things I'd say, honestly. In the analysis I'm giving of the death drive, I'm kind of drawing on some silent partners here, but there's a lot of critical theory and a lot of psychoanalytic theory that looks to the interwar period between World War I and World War II as like a test case for a lot of these concepts, or at least it's really dramatizing, right? And one of the examples and narratives is sort of given, and by the way, none of this is about moral exculpation. Nothing I'm saying here is about forgiving people or doing any of that. This is purely analytical, right? One thing that you can explain about or like, you know, get some insight into the character of reactionary violence in the mode of like Fry Corps or paramilitary death squads or the passive indifference of liberal elites to the conditions on the ground in farmer Germany and the early Nazi era is you can understand that in relation to the mass trauma of World War I, essentially, you have a situation where a society of, you know, it faces a mass trauma, both of perpetration, but also of loss, right? Something like 2 out of every 5 German households loses either like the male breadwinner or a close like male relative, but also guilt of perpetration combined with this sort of incoherent experience of battlefield stasis followed by the, you know, the stab in the back myth of like Versailles. We didn't win, but somehow we didn't lose, but somehow now here we are being humiliated, et cetera. And that what that produces, in other words, is a kind of psychotic cultural normalcy, or what you call a malignant normalcy, that raises a generation or several generations of young men to reproduce a social order solely in the mode of projecting death, right? So, like, there's a way in which, like, you can read the violence of post-World War I German society as being a function not just of material deprivation, but also like collective psychic trauma and a failure to properly mourn and take responsibility. At a bare minimum level, I would say that any society in which there is mass death that doesn't have some sort of collective working through or mourning is going to pay the price. That's going to out. It's like a basic psychoanalytic thing. The repressed doesn't go away. It returns. So if we don't have some sort of collective mourning for a million plus dead, that's going to out, whether that outs through imperial war or you know, collective social dislocation or just intensified normality of violence. Who knows? But, like, that outs. And so, like, what it would mean to put on the couch, like, well, you need people to slow down, right? You need to give people breathing room. And I think you can sort of think about the refusal to accommodate people, whether it be through student debt relief or through checks or through, you know, mailing them N95. Like, this refusal to let people to draw a breath is about preventing that type of collective working through to happen. Because if you give people, if people are not on their toes constantly, then they might slow down. They might think about the possibility of things would be otherwise. But if you give them anything, well, you know, you can't. You have to keep rushing forward, even if that means death. Because at least, like, we can, if there's any one thing this country is really good at, is taking on sustainable things and just keep on doubling down on them. But I do think, like, that if we were to give people something, if we were to actually pause for a moment, like, well, maybe we don't need to grow in this way. Maybe we don't need, maybe our lifestyle is negotiable. Maybe we don't need to keep on building. Maybe people don't need to get back to work. Maybe the normal isn't that good to begin with. We could actually take a few breathers. Maybe there's a point where just the unsustainability of everything that's happening now and the way that we double down on what's unsustainable hits a critical point where there are openings where individuals or collectivities can be like, no, it doesn't have to be this way. That's like a revolutionary impulse. It's a, in the sense that it overturns what's pre-existing, to the extent to which the status quo is so obviously killing people and so obviously indifferent to anyone's well-being. The appeal of why not try something different feels pretty real to me.
I was Patrick Blanchfield, an associate faculty member of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His essay on the death drive appears in that institute's journal, Late Light. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. A year ago, I ended my last show of 2020 with a bit of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony as a musical embodiment of hope for some sort of rebirth in 2021. Well, things didn't turn out quite that way. So now, perhaps under a fruitless compulsion to repeat, I'll try the same move as 2021 is about to turn into 2022. This is a bit of the final movement of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next year, bye.